talk about Biafra a lot in our house because we're Nigerians. And he is just adamant about, like, the North seceding. And I'm just like, that's a ridiculous idea. That is just, that's just not something that should happen. But from his reference point, he's like, I saw them. I saw the, you know, the Igbos coming on vans and trucks and just, like, half dead in Lagos. And, like, he's like, you didn't see that. And that was the North. And for me, I'm just saying, there's one Nigeria. We can't separate. Like, there's just that very, like, weird intersection of I'm very idealist about what I want for Nigeria and like my plans, and he's just like you haven't been there, you don't know, you haven't been there in a while, and you just don't know.
The ethnic chauvinism.
Yeah.
No, I think there is a generation gap. We support different leaders than our parents or our grandparents will support, because they've experienced different things that we've experienced. I remember talking to my mother back in 2005 when Uganda had elections, and that was when I was, I guess, the age where I could actually vote for the first time. And I knew my mom was going to vote for Museveni, and I asked her, you know, why would you vote for Museveni? And then she said that, well, you know, because you haven't been around when they were growing up. She had during the war, during Idi Amin, during all that time where it was really crazy. She would tell me stories that she only had like a bowl of porridge a day. Sometimes she would go for days without food. They would have to, you know, they were very afraid of soldiers. They used to hide in many places. Lots of her family were killed. So many people she knew were killed. Her career was put at a stop. So many terrible things happened to her. So now when she's gone through 20 years of peace, she doesn't want to do anything to upset that. So she's fine with the status quo. Things might not change the way the younger generation would like to change. They want more things to happen quicker. But she's fine with the fact that there's peace. And the one guy that brought that peace is Museveni. So a lot of the older generation will say to the younger generation, you guys don't know what you're doing. You haven't been around to, you know, experience what we've experienced. If you did, then you would understand why we're going this way. So, I mean, it's good to understand why they would vote a certain way. They have a reason for voting that way, but we come from a different time and have experienced different things.
And I think it's valid, you know, and it has to be recognized for what it is. But, you know, in order for us as countries to be able to go through the steps and evolve, we definitely have to, you know, have that debate and make sure that, you know, it's understood that we are the future generation and we need to set things in motion. Yes. We weren't there, you know, when hard times were there. We go into different things, and that's just what, you know, how it is. But we have to be able to, as also the younger generation, be able to get into, be in civil society, be in the political circles, you know, be able to engage. Because I feel like, you know, the older generation basically it's like, you haven't been there, so I don't want to hear what you have to say. You know, not everybody. I'm talking, let's say, at the political level. And not opening that door and being able to let you in and say, okay, I have not been there, you know, and the country has, you know, I thank you for what you've done, but I also have a voice. And I also see things in a different way, you know, which might not be contrary to what, you know, you think, but it's just another way. And I feel like, you know, we have not been able to still, you know, there are little steps that are being made, but I don't feel like that I've had the voice, you know, to be able to sit at the table, mm-hmm. sitting at that table and saying, yes, mm-hmm. you know, different, I don't know all things, you know, wise, you know, but I think that we would benefit. We are interdependent at the end of the day.
I completely disagree.
You know?
Okay. I mean, it's been 50 years of them at the table, and the way the continent is right now is not great, like, if we're going to be honest with ourselves.
I think we're agreeing, actually. I said you have to be able to sit down at the table.
I want them out of the table.
They are not, but that's not realistic. That's not how it's going to go. Otherwise, the door will still be closed.
Because, I mean, it might be a little radical, but I just... they've done nothing. And that is always my argument, is that the status quo has not worked for the last 5 decades. It hasn't worked.
Again, country by country. Yeah. You can't generalize.
Name a country that's working.
name a country that's working?
Country by country.
There's Botswana. There are, you know, and as I said, you cannot take one, and that's what the mistake that we make sometimes. You can't just lump everybody in the same. There are different problems, different countries, and you have to look at it that way. And also, as you said, I would like to all of them to be out of here. I agree with you. Out, but you can't because that's not how it works. You have to be able to, you know, because, again, they're going to look at you as a young person who's just, you know, who likes to do, I mean, as children.
Yeah.
You know, you just want what you want, but you know nothing.
Yeah.
So I'll put you to the side. You know, but you have to be smart, exactly, to be smart about it. And if the plan is getting them out, you have to be, you have that plan. Even if you like, I have to deal with this one who just doesn't want to, and it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
Honestly, I don't know if my conversation, to go back to your question, with my dad would be very different. And I think it's because the situation in Cameroon is very different.
Mm-hmm.
We've had two presidents since the independence, one that resigned and the other one that arrived in 1982. So he's been there for almost 30 years. He's been the president of, I mean, so the voting age in Cameroon is 20 years old. My dad, when he arrived into office, was 24. So throughout his, not life, but like, you know, his youth, he was the president. Now, my dad stopped voting, I think 10 years ago, because it's just in Cameroon, it's a whole nother situation. We, the president just changed the constitution here and then whenever he wants to add more, a longer term of office, or when he wants to run for another year, he changes the constitution. So there in Cameroon, no one likes the president. I mean, you have, I guess, 10% maybe, or 5%. But no one agrees that he should be reelected. The last election was last year.
Mm-hmm.
No one said anything about it. No one reacted to it. No one even cared about it. Oh, he's still president? Okay, good. We're just waiting for him to die. So all the generation agrees on that, because there is no political participation in Cameroon. No, people don't vote anymore because you know your vote doesn't count. Even when people register to vote, the voter cards are not given out to people. So it's just there might be this generational gap, but it's more between the 20 people in power and the rest. And then after it gets divided between opposition, that is divided in 20 other sectors, but they're the same political party divided, and then the rest of people are just waiting for something better, which is not out there. The solution doesn't exist.
Let's stay on this topic, and let me introduce a few more pieces of information. To maybe incite you. So the Africa Economic Outlook came out a few months ago, and one of the first bullet points in the report was that the number of youths in Africa are going to double by 2045. So in a very short period of time, the number of people under the age of 25 or 30 is going to double. And the way that this has been characterized by many think tanks and even some scholars is the youth bulge.
Mm-hmm.
And the youth bulge is, you know, an interesting choice of words, because it immediately, I think, evokes for us again something negative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you think of youth bulge, you think of angry, young, unemployed men carrying guns. And what I'm hearing from you all is that the youth bulge also articulates something that has to do with political disenchantment and a different kind of vision, which isn't part of the mainstream discourse. However, this is the other piece of information that I wanted to introduce, and that is there's this great temptation also to romanticize youth a little bit. And this is, you know, the history of the United States in the 50s and 60s, for example, where a youth culture emerged because the youth was identified as a market and as a group of consumers, as a class of consumers. And so Afrobarometer surveys across 19 countries, and I'm saying this against Mamkadi's sound advice about generalizing, but across 19 countries last year found that at the height of the Arab Spring, this is happening, across 19 countries, that in comparison with older citizens, young people do vote less, perhaps for the reasons that Estelle just outlined. They have a lower level of partisanship, So weaker affiliations, sort of political parties that are out there, and that youth are not more likely to protest. So they don't even necessarily engage in politics outside the system when they're disenfranchised by the system. So how will you get these views and voices and visions heard? I mean, what are your tools? What are your visions? And where do you go from here?
So kind of taking this back to the last question, I think that when we look at the history of Africa, the last time that, like you said, the youth picked up guns and were trying to rile people up, there was a negative consequence because after independence, essentially the liberation that was fought for was lost. You see this in Chinua Achebe's books. You see this in Nguju Wathiongo's books. It was just that after independence, there was a lot of hope. There was a lot of aspirations for people, and that was all lost. If you look in the analysis of scholars like C.L.R. James and even Kwame Nkrumah himself, he says this is because the kind of that energy was kind of all shifted into the party and the party apparatus, and just like Kwame Nkrumah's ideological institute trying to like educate people rather than trying to expand, the idea of nation building rather than politics to everyone. And the legacy of that is that in the present day, the older generation now are very wary of that and wary of that radicalism because they realize that after all they fought for, it was just a few people, like you said, a few politicians who were able to get that power. And so nowhere in Africa, I don't think would you have someone tell the kid to want to be a politician when you grow up. I think your parents will actually get upset if you want to be a politician. And I think this is a big problem because if there's no one who is like aiming for nation building, you know, to do civic work, to work in as a minister of education or work in like relevant institutions that we do need, there's no way we're going to move forward. It's going to be the same people who've always held on to power who are going to be holding on to power. So it doesn't matter that the youth, there are more youth, and they will not protest because since they were children, they've always been told not to want to be involved in politics because politics is something that bad men do and just to make money. You know, even today when you look at when speaking in Ghana, at the universities, the people who run for student government are people who are all affiliated with the major political parties, and it's not independent of the parties. You know, so it's like revolving door where people are just like, as soon as you get involved, you don't want to get involved, you have to be part of this system. So I think we have to be able to break away from that, and a big part of that has to be decentralization of whole political process. And again, I'm going to use this word again, but I think looking at politics as nation building rather than just two parties trying to, I guess, clamor for the nation's resources.
I think we saw something like this, a new form of political activism in Senegal.
I was just going to raise that.
Maybe you can talk about it better than I will. With the elections, I felt so sad to realize that we didn't talk about it that much. Because it was something incredible. You have a rap, it started with rappers. So it's an artistic movement that managed to bring down the constitutional change that the president wanted. The president was like 86 years old or something like this. So it's something was someone that didn't want to accept change or reform or anything from no one. And he listened to a youth movement of rappers. I mean, I think this is incredible. And that was in 2011, so it's not something old. Very recent.
And it even started before, because if you remember the previous elections when Watt came to power, you know, the rappers also, you know, were mobilized and asked people to go ahead and vote so that, you know, change could happen. So I think, you know, you still get youth, you know, involved. They may not, you know the crux and crux of, you know, the political process and et cetera, but I think they are aware of what they would like to see their country, where they would like to see their country go. One, and two, you know, they know, you know, what's wrong and what's not, you know, in terms of, you know, excessive corruption, period, being able to see that services, goods and services are not being provided adequately to all strata of society. And so, you know, in 2011, also they were able to, you know, galvanize people and also, you know, tell them that this is our constitution. We the people. You know, this is not your monarchy. This is not, you know, something that, you know, you can just decide that it's going to be this way, you know, as a president, and then we're going to follow. So I think that there is that consciousness, and also, you know, knowing that, you know, they are able to go to the streets and protest, you know, peacefully, of course. You know, it came, it had, you know, police came out and did what they were not supposed to do, and they need to be trained better to know that these are peaceful protests and they didn't need to react the way they did. But I think the youth was involved, and they are the ones at the end of the day who pressured the president and also made sure that the rest of the country knew that, you know, we have a voice as well. And they are just, I was just reading in the news, and they are ready to also call, you know, the current president to, or to be like, yes, you know, you are here, and you, we need to see things, we need to see things happen. And I think they are following, you know, what's currently going on as well. And one other thing also that I was going to say is that, you know, as you said, you know, we need to see youth as, you know, we are not all saints, you know, at the end of the day. You know, we have different, again, we are not the homogeneous entity. And, you know, when you said that the youth bulge is, you know, associated with negativity, it is true. I mean, when we talk about youth bulge, you think about, you know, countries where, you know, the youth have guns and shoes and went out there, you know, put people and in post-conflict because of unemployment. What do you think first? Oh, they might pick up the guns again and come and perpetrate, you know, all sorts of acts. And I think now, you know, hopefully the discourse is changing in that, you know, they need to be seen as an asset. Yes, you know, no need to over, you know, kind of do it. But they need to be seen as an asset, people who are creative, innovative, and able to bring new ideas to the table as well. And it takes investing in them. And I think what, you know, politicians or people miss is that, you know, and I'm talking about political positions on the African point, you know, and that's what they need to realize, that they need to invest in their youth, and that they are full of ideas and things that can be harder.
Taking back on what you're saying, I think it's really just about opportunity. I think in Nigeria, the economy grew by 7%, something like that last year. The unemployment rate in general, is 23-point-something%, and for the youth, it's staggering. It's in the 60s. 60% of Nigerians under 25 are not employed or underemployed. And that's a government estimate, so you know it's way higher than that. Like, that is very conservative. And so when you have people not working and without opportunities, you get that scary youth bulge with guns and machetes or whatever, because they can call them up on Monday morning and offer them food and say, here's this. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think absolutely right. It's like investing in jobs. It's about opportunity, and it's just not there for them right now. So, like, there is going to be that disenchantment with political world and the economy, because there's nothing for them to do. There's absolutely nothing in a lot of countries for people our age to do. And so the act of even being political active is just not even there. It's about feeding myself this morning and actually getting food. And, like, it's just basic. Like, the basic necessities that's needed to actually be political active, it's just not there. And so,
yeah, well, in last year in Uganda, a lot of a lot of youth walked to work to protest, walking to work to protest against the conditions in Uganda regarding food, commodities,
right,
et cetera, prices are rising, and so on. So, but they were cracked down upon, a lot were put in jail, it was seen as something very negative. You know, they saw them, the government saw them as being hooligans, you know, disrupting public peace, and so on. So fine, you know, that youth have, you know, sometimes do have protests where they try to gain those rights, but then the reaction is always in the negative way. So how are we able to bridge that gap,
mm-hmm,
that the authorities see the youth as you were saying, as an investment, as something that they can work with to help better the country, instead of seeing their actions as something detrimental?
I want to ask a question about women and use that for a segue into some sociological conversations about demographics. So here's the question about women, and I want to set this one up as well. Has the success of women such as Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala given us an incomplete picture of the changing role of women on the continent? Example, Search for Common Ground just released a report called Youth to Youth about work they've been doing in Liberia. And one of their findings is that they say, while older women are increasingly holding positions of power, young women continue to be much more hesitant to engage in politics than their male counterparts. And they go on to discuss this, and then they say, young men are also unprepared to adapt to the changing roles of women in society. So tell us about this incomplete picture, and then Gazito and Michael, tell us if you're ready.
I want to go straight to the example of Liberia after the Civil War, and I think that it was the women in Liberia who essentially ended the Civil War. And I guess we see Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as a leader today, and I think that when it comes down to it, honestly, the feudal vestiges in Africa and, like, I guess the old customs and the old laws are going to be gone soon. And it comes down to bare necessity, because when you need, if there is a woman who can provide for you, and just like you said, it's about what you can eat or you can get a job, you're not going to say, because this the woman owns this company, so I'm not going to work for her. I think that things have changed a lot also because comparing myself to my father's generation, I know a lot of my father's sisters couldn't go to school and had to stay home so he could go to school. But that's changing a lot. There are a lot of women would be educated, consequently, women educating more men. And so there's an increased place for, I guess, women in the public sphere, and women also, I guess, helping educate more people. You know, so I think that things are certainly, like, still negative for women in a lot of aspects, but I think it is changing, and it's changing for the better, because an example is Uganda with a lot of women in Congress. And Kenya with the one-third rule now, trying to include more women in a public space, because I think we realize that women really do care. Women really do speak for the things which are necessary, as we're talking about again, healthcare, education, food, all these things, and less about the politics. And I apologize for generalizing women, but I think it's going to a positive effect for discourse on the continent.
Yeah, I would say changes happen.
Wait a minute, we gotta hear from
you. You forgot George Banda.
Yes.
Okay.
But I think those women are just one in a few. I mean, you mentioned Ms. Iweala. Like, Nigeria has never had a female governor elected.
True.
Never. And if you look at the quota system in all these countries, a lot of times, the men do things on purpose to, like, push women out or, like, silence their voice. They schedule things at night so women who have children can come. They oftentimes just have, like, the ANC, for example. It's very, very patriarchal. And if you're aligned with me, then you can come into our table. But a lot of times, like, the men still hold the ground. And so while I see that these women are very powerful and it's good to see them, on the world stage, African women still have such a hurdle to overcome, and these are one in a few.
I agree with you, okay. I mean, I'll give you two examples. So you mentioned that Uganda, one-third of our parliament has to be composed of women. That's a lie. So 33% of our parliament are women ministers. Even though they have political participation, I feel that they do not yet have the same power that with their male colleagues. Just relating it to, like, a traditional example, I remember 20 years ago when I went back home to the village. Back then, the elders used to sit in the family hut, and then the women and the children sat outside. The women and the children will go inside, serve the men their food, and then they'll go and they'll sit outside in the mat. Move on 15, 20 years. Now the women sit in the same room as the men. There's no longer a separation, but yet the men still make the main decisions regarding how the family is governed. And I kind of see the same way, the same example with politics in Uganda.
Yeah, I definitely think that, and I was just thinking about it last time in terms of women presidents and what sets them apart, as we like to, to think, it's great that they're been able to, people voted for them, they are at the, they've worked hard to get where they got to, but these are just a few. Again, we're talking about women presidents, ministers, you have ministers, over in, as well as parliamentarians. Are they enough? In my opinion, no. But at the same time, women, girl, and, you know, education is very important, and I think there is still a lot more to be done, and it's also about changing